It's very appropriate that we are having a class here today to talk about another polytheistic system. And I would not be aware of any rabbi who would say that Hinduism is anything but a avodah zarah. But I still think that there's, specifically in light of the Sheikhl controversy, which is 2 or 3 years old at this point, the importance of understanding Hinduism, the importance of understanding some of its practices becomes very, very important. So I'm going to introduce the class by giving out a handout from an article written by my friend, Rabbi Joshua Fluk, in the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society. I hope that people here are a little bit familiar with this journal. It's also known as the RJJ Journal. And Rabbi Fluk gives us a description of some of the ideas that prompted the brouhaha over this issue. So, I'm going to pass the first sheet around over here. Is everyone aware of the Sheikhl controversy? Basically, a large source of the human hair is the core ingredient of all the Sheikhls, or many of the Sheikhls that are produced around the world. One of the big sources was India. And what would happen is that the Indians would travel to a temple where they would shave their heads at some point during the process of visiting that temple. And the question became, what then is the status of that in the eyes of halakha of the hair that's the product of that process? So we're going to look now, beginning on page 14 from the Journal of Contemporary Society. This is journal number 49, published in spring 2005. Okay? Despite the aforementioned argument to prohibit the hair from the temple, Rabbi Yashim in a 1989 response, and the interesting thing here was that there was actually a change, there was a shift in how the halacha responded to this question of the hair that was produced at that temple. Originally, the psak was dating to the 1980s, was that it was mutter, it was permitted to utilize that hair. He gave four reasons to rule leniently. Why is it that the hair produced at that temple was permissible? First, Hinduism does not consider the hair an offering. In fact, the hair is considered to be impure, and the hair may not even enter the temple. Which, in fact, we'll see whether we're going to see whether that's true or not as we continue on. Therefore, it is not considered an object that is normally offered to that particular idol, and cannot be considered tikrovet avodah zarah, which means that which is offered before an idol. In other words, not only are idols themselves forbidden in Jewish law, but also the bringing or the materials that were once brought before an idol is also forbidden, which is why if you eat in certain restaurants, you have to be careful about whether the food is kosher. You have to be worried about what sort of idol might be in the back of the restaurants. If they're presenting the food before the avodah zarah and then they're giving you a little bit of the shirayim, you might have a problem on your hands. I'm not aware of any restaurants in New York where this is in fact a problem, but in theory it could be a real issue. Rav Yashim argued that even second, this is the second point on page 15, argued that even if the worshippers intend to offer their hair to the idol, one should not assume that the barbers have intent to offer the hair to the idol, as they are fully aware of the fact that the hair is sold and not offered to the idol. Because this is what happens, the temple itself would make a huge profit on selling this hair in tremendous quantities, because there were upwards of 50,000 people who would go there every day, and there would be, I think, 15,000 haircuts a day, which people would shave off their entire head in order to go into this temple. They still have 500 barbers who are employed full-time, working 24 hours a day, if you run shift and shifts, constantly shaving off people's heads. We'll see. In this specific temple, and we'll see what that comes from as far as that religion goes and the ideas that are behind it. Because again, we're going to find here, as we found in our study of Buddhism and stuff, and I think we've found in the study of all different religions, that there's going to be disparity between what you read in the books and what people say when they do things. There are often, not just one Hinduism, but there might be, 900 million Buddhisms, because it's slightly different for everybody. There's certainly the tremendous disparity between the common man and the priests. Okay, there's going to be a tremendous discrepancy between those two as far as this issue goes, and it's going to have a tremendous impact on the halacha. So Rabbi Yashar argued that even if the worshippers intend to offer their head to the idol, even then when they take the haircut, they think that, what should happen, the barbers, the people doing the cutting of the hair, have intent to offer the hair to the idol. Because the barbers themselves, they know where the hair is going. They're going to some Schaefermacher in Brooklyn. They know that. The Mishnah in Chulin 38b states, if a Jew slaughters an animal of an idol worshipper with intent to eat the animal, or with no intention at all, even if the idol worshipper intends the slaughtering be done for the idol, the animal is nevertheless permitted. It is not considered to kroves avodah zarah, as the intent of the slaughterer is the intent of the slaughter is defined by the slaughterer and not by the owner. It's the person who's doing the act that defines the act, not the person who's receiving the act or allowing for the act to take place. Similarly, the intent of the haircut is defined by the barber and not by the customer. Since the barber's intention is not to offer the hair, they are not considered to cover the avodah zarah. Third, the Gemara implies that if the breaking of the stick is not done in the presence of the idol, the stick would not be considered to cover the avodah zarah. Because in order for a given action to be considered to be a form of worship of an idol, it has to take place in front of the idol. If you do it at home and then bring the proceeds to the idol, that doesn't count. If you do it at home and then you're doing it the shema, it doesn't count. If you're doing it the shame that avodah zarah, it doesn't count. For the purpose or for the name of the avodah zarah, that doesn't count. It has to be in front of the idol. While the grapes were ostensibly not cut in the presence of the idol, there is a certain distinction between grapes that are obviously offered in the Beit HaMikdash as bikurim, and a stick that is not intrinsically prohibited, but rather prohibited because that particular idol is worshipped by the stick. The hair is comparable to the stick and not the grapes, as the only reason to consider the hair as an object of worship is to claim the hair is normally offered to that particular idol. And that would not be the case in this situation, because the hair in this temple is not brought before the idol, rather it's gone and then sold. They don't burn it or they don't bring it in front of the idol, they go and they take it and they bring it somewhere else. Fourth. That's going to be a very important question. So then why are they doing it? Why are they doing it? Now that's number four, I think. Is that it comes up here? Yes, here, it's number four. Based on the information presented to Rebbe Yashiv, Yashiv, of course, is a modern-day scholar in Israel, very perhaps the Godel Hador in many, many issues. Rebbe Yashiv felt that the entire practice should not be considered idol worship at all. It is merely a sacrifice of the ego in order to stand in the presence of the idol with a lesser physical self. What is it when a person goes to this temple in India? What's the kavana behind this custom of the Hindus in Tirupati? What is the reason behind it? To get rid yourself of your physical, ostentatious hair, to humble yourself before the idol. That's what it's about. So it's lahefek. You think that this is some form of worship? It's to remove the physical barriers and come close to the idol and getting rid of the hair. That's the real components. Everyone with me? That's the real intention, yes.
It's still, he does it in order to please the idol.
But the key point here is that we want to define the material itself. Is that material itself part of a service to the idol? Or is it the shirayim, or it's like less than shirayim. It's like
it's a negative service.
It's a negative thing, exactly. So look, if the idol worshiper in the
still, it's done with the idea of worshiping. It's closer to idol worship than to drink the wine.
So let me ask you a question. Let's say you live in New York, and there are some idol worshippers in New York. Let's say, I'm sure there are many idol worshippers in New York, and one of these idol worshippers shines your shoes for you. And the idol worshiper does everything, the shame, the anti-yichud, opposite of yichud, kushab yichud. Okay? He's doing it, the shame of avodah zarah. Shines your shoes for you. Does that count? You know, if he has this whole philosophy, everything's the shame, his idol. Does that make your shoe usher?
No,
it has to be in the context of something of worship. So if he's getting rid of his hair, he's getting rid of his hair. It's his business. Now, if the next moment he's going into the temple to worship, okay, it's something separate. But we need to make it answer, it has to be part of the worship process itself. That seems not to be the case here, according to this first understanding in 1989. Okay?
Excuse me, the concept of idolatry, idol worship, it's so obsolete and so outdated. I don't think that we would have to worry about it today.
This is so wonderful. We come to these classes every week, and every time I sit, I say, well, you know, maybe Christianity isn't Avodah Zarah, certainly Islam is not Avodah Zarah, maybe even, you know, Buddhism has some philosophies. No rabbi says that Hinduism is not Avodah Zarah, as far as I'm aware. I've never seen a rabbi who says that. Hinduism, as practiced, is almost vada Avodah Zarah. I will give you some of the insights within it, so you at least understand it to some degree, and can appreciate it to some degree. But we believe that halacha has something to say throughout time. We are Orthodox Jews. Orthodox Jews say that even though, you know, you can eat pork and you'll still be healthy, that doesn't change the fact that Kosher Pork does not want to eat pork. Simply, God does not want us to take materials that we worship for Avodah Zarah and put them on our heads. God does not want that wants to do that. We believe that. That's what Torah says. Torah says that Avodah Zarah, to grow with Avodah Zarah is awesome. Those are obsolete. Okay. Based on the
another point, we talk in terms of values today rather than gods, worshipping gods, different gods, foreign gods. We talk mostly in terms of values.
This is Meiri you're talking about. The Meiri who said that our idolaters today, the Christians, he says, are not really idolaters as defined by halacha because they have some ethical system of some sort and therefore they are bound by that system and so on and so forth. So whether the Meir would apply to Hinduism or not, that's a separate question. I mean, I'm not sure that any halakhic authorities that have gone through the trouble to analyze that as yet, but we'll see with them. Perhaps there's room to go with something there. That's a very good point. We'll get there, okay? Let's take our time. Meiri lived in the 14th century, I would say. Maybe 15th century?
Where?
In Provence. In southern France. Yeah. Okay?
Is this whole discussion only applied to stuff that you really know was used possibly for Avodah Zarah? I mean, if anything came from a person from India.
Right, so that becomes part of the later quip issue in this article. If you can continue on to read Josh Flew's article about the possibility of mixtures, the possibility of thistle, question of whether you can, whether soft take about Avodah Zarah when it mixes in. That's a very good question that we would have. I would encourage you to read the rest of the article to discuss. I want to focus on the religion point and the analysis of halacha when trying to come up with a decision as far as the status of another religion. Yes?
Normally when you've been discussing these other religions, you started with like an overview.
We will get there. I want to jump right in with this. This is what I wanted to
stimulate
your interest. We will get to it. You will not be leave here, God willing, without some basic understanding of Hinduism. Okay?
The hair is impure, and it has to get rid of it in order to call it as God.
Impure might be the wrong word, although some people use that terminology. I think a better way to say it is that it is a barrier in that thought to coming close to the God. You need to remove the barrier to come close to the God.
So that's not a holy thing.
That was the first approach. That was certainly the first approach.
That's
and
the point, right?
So far. But we're going to see something else. And then you know what changed in 1989 compared to 2004. What was the revolution? What was the big deal? So we're going to get there, okay? So these are these four reasons. Rabbi Yoshua ruled that using the hair from the temple in Tirupati is permitted. However, he qualifies really by stating that everything is subject to change, as this whole response is based on the facts presented to him, and should the facts change, the law may change as well. Let's see what happens.
Yashiv
was from the Turi Karta? No, Yashiv is not from the Turi Karta. He is a Haredi rabbi. He's a Gaon in the Gadol Hador, who's a very no matter what his politics are, I don't know his politics. He's Talmud Chacham that we have to take seriously. Okay, let's turn to page 18, following along here. Over time, people knowledgeable in Hinduism, as well as Bali Tshuva, repenters, who partook in these ritual practices in Tirupati, started to question the facts presented in 1989 responsum. In 2004, at the behest of Rebbe Yashuv, Rav Aharon Dunner was sent to Tirupati to examine the practice and to interview some of the worshippers. A prior investigation, Rabbi Dunner made six observations. One, the worshippers claim that the reason why they are cutting their hair is because the idol likes hair. Who is he asking? He's asking the people when they walk to the temple. So, Rav Hindu, Rav Hindu, why are you doing this? What's going on? Well, the answer is, the idol likes hair. They did not mention anything about this philosophy of self-sacrifice and all this other, philosophy business. The idol likes hair. Furthermore, there are some who only cut part of their hair. When questioned whether they only cut part of the hair, they answered that at least one can do is cut part of the hair. This was interpreted to mean that the purpose is not to bald oneself, but to give hair to the idol. Two, the worshippers did not consider hair to be impure. Not impure. In fact, some of the worshippers even brought hair into the temple, and nobody stopped them. That must be that, people actually taking some of the hair and bringing it into the temple. Three, when the barbers were asked about their intentions, they responded, they have in mind to do whatever the customer has in mind. They did not consider their job to be an ordinary job, but rather considered it religious in nature. There's also something that changed. That happens to be, I think, a couple of 5 years ago or something. They actually built a whole building for the purpose of having the Sheikh's Mansion. 500 barbers working at once. It's a huge area. It's a lot of hair. It's a lot of people. And they wanted to streamline the process. What used to happen was people would get their hair cut back where they were staying, back in their apartments or whatever, the hotels they were staying in, going to the temple. And they centralized the whole process. So there really was a change over what was going on in the temple as a result of this tremendous market for what's known as tonsuring. For the worshippers were asked why they specifically came to Tirupati to receive a haircut and did not cut their hair at home. They responded that this place has a connection to the idol. So even though it's not in the temple, there's a separate building in the temple complex, they still felt that this building in the temple complex was different than getting your haircut back at home. Five. The worshippers at the time of their haircut recite the name of the idol. They actually say it at the time. Number six. The building that houses the barbershop has an idol in the lobby. Additionally, one is prohibited from wearing shoes in the barbershop. Based on these new facts, the usher observed that the worshippers and barbers do not perform this practice in a manner consistent with understanding of Hindu priests and experts in Hinduism as per the 1989 ruling. There was a difference between what the Hindu experts were saying and what the Hindu on the street was saying. They were not wholly from the same philosophy. The philosophers were saying, why is there this practice? To remove the hair that is a barrier between the physical and the spiritual and all this other stuff. What did the man on the street say? The idol wants my hair. And comes about Yashin says, what really matters? I don't care about all this fancy philosophy. What I care about is, what the guy on the street think? That's what I don't care about now. He felt that one should classify the practice based on the way the worshippers practice, and not based on the way the experts claim it should be practiced. Remember our first class. Remember what we started with. Our first class in which we spoke about two religions in every situation. There's the religion in the ideal form, and then the religion as it's lived. Everyone who's read the article about Orthodox Judaism is written by Noah Feldman. He quoted three Jews during the course of his article. Three Orthodox Jews. Who were they? Yigal Amir, Baruch Goldstein, and who's the third guy? Sarah Lieberman. Three Orthodox Jews. So you can see the difference. The ideal and then the reality. So when you project towards somebody else, you always think of them as they live with their religion. We think about ourselves. We think about Orthodox Jews. When we as Orthodox Jews, who we think about as an Orthodox Jew? I think that was Soloveitchik. That was an Orthodox Jew. Idol Kinsera, the guy who was arrested in Washington, D.C. for bribing, was it Abramoff? Abramoff is not an Orthodox Jew. But in Matthew, for most Goyim in Washington, D.C., they think Orthodox Jew, they think about Abramoff, they think about Rav Soloveitchik. They don't know about Abramoff. Abramoff. So he comes to the question and says,
why do you want to be devil's advocate?
Yes.
Why do you say Abramoff is not an Orthodox?
I don't think about him when I think about Orthodox Judaism. I know, I'm not going to throw him out of synagogue. You know, come, I'm not asking him. Look, you know, people make sense. You know, people are not always perfect, and you know, Jews who sin are still welcome to come into the synagogue and hopefully do Shuba one day. I have no problem with him as a man. I have surprised the problem with what he did. And you know, but the reason I quoted that was not so much to say, you know, he's not an Orthodox Jew. I'm saying is that when I think about Orthodox Judaism as an Orthodox Jew, I don't think about him. He's not my model. He's not my stereotype. My stereotype is our salvation. That's an Orthodox Jew. Okay. So getting back to our Hinduism situation here, the Yajna says you have to focus on what the reality is. Not what the philosophers are saying. He's talking about what the reality is. What goes on in the temple. Based on the perspective of the worshippers, the Yajna concluded that the haircut itself is considered an offering to the idol. Furthermore, since the barbers themselves have the same intentions as the worshippers, there are no rest releasing based on the fact that the barbers have no intention to offer the hair. The only ground leniency that remains is that the cutting is not done in the presence of the idol. To address this issue, the Yashin quotes from Shlomo Kluger, who claims that if the action is done explicitly for the purpose of the Avodah Zarah, there is no requirement that the action be done in the presence of the idol. Here, just as the worshipper recites the name of the idol, there should be no requirement that the cutting be performed in the presence of the idol. Yes?
In this thing that you read here, it says the experts may have something to gain by portraying a religion in the idol.
Right.
What would they have to gain by portraying a religion?
Well, if you're in America, you call an expert on Hinduism and ask him, let me ask you, Mr. Expert on Hinduism, you're living here in San Francisco. I was wondering, do you think that Hinduism is a polytheistic religion? Do you think that Hinduism is idolatry? And he would say, well, man, of course Hinduism is not idolatry. It has a very deep philosophical basis behind it. And that all these idols that you see actually represent something very, very deep. Because idolatry in America has a very negative connotation to it. This is a Judeo-Christian society in which we are very much built upon all sorts of stereotypes against idolatry. So the experts you're going to call here in America, perhaps even if you go to India, you go to consult an expert. They're not going to tell you that Hinduism is a form of idolatry. Chas v'shalom. The experts really know. The experts are having... The guy in the street doesn't know. But the experts are busy having their, interfaith dialogue. And they're going to tell you Hinduism is in fact not religion number one. They're going to tell you that it's not certainly not idolatry. It's something very, very different.
So what do they say about all the idols?
Oh, we'll see about that. We'll get there. Don't worry about it. We're on our way there. Ooh. Whoa. Well, number one, the idols in the Catholic Church typically are represent...
We're back to square one.
Yes. They typically represent saints. Most ones you'll see there are saints. And the Christians themselves say that they don't worship the saints, even the Catholics.
Yeah.
But they do. They say that they do. They have candles. And they have separate little...
Well, number one, as we said in our class on Christianity, many post-Schism facts say Christianity is a form of idolatry. And we saw that the Rabbeinu Tam thought that was actually Sheet Tov, which they actually worship God, but they combine in God this principle of Jesus.
As intermediary,
so right.
Maybe they also see
it. Oh, okay, we're going to get there. Hang on. What? Let's...
Well, the devil should seem to be out of here. You should die in half an hour.
Okay, so we're going to go through a little bit of a thumbnail section. What Hinduism is. And then we're going to come back and we're going to look at what the website of this temple in India has to set down. So these places have websites. It's really an amazing thing. But have you been to this temple in Tirupati? Tirupati? Okay. The pictures on their website, it's a beautiful place. But, I'm not allowed to praise, I should praise the beauty of such things. I don't know, if it's all right, I'm going to get in trouble. Okay, I'm not going to only want to encourage people to go and have a look. So let's talk a little bit about Hinduism. So as we always do in these classes, let me throw it open to the floor. What are your impressions of Hinduism? What is Hinduism? Nothing much.
When we were in India.
Nothing much in the halakhic sense. Is it like not really a bodhisattva? Or nothing much in the sense that, I don't really care.
I don't think it was really, I don't think Buddhism was really religion either. No, it didn't seem to me to be a religion. It really didn't seem to be a religion. You know, they're big gods and everything, and not religious.
Okay.
And that's not religious.
Okay. And what gave you the sense that it wasn't religious? Think about it. How much money did they spend on those to build those temples?
Oh, the temple, that's what the red dots.
Okay.
The temples, I think every temple that we saw that was a Hindu temple was ancient. I don't think we saw a Mayan temple.
But so you're saying that it was once religion, but it's not being religion?
Yeah, I think so. That's my opinion.
Wow. And
okay. They're like lapsed Christians.
Lapsed Christians.
Yeah.
That
was and the 50,000 people who go and get their haircuts at these places?
Well, I mean, I didn't see them.
You didn't meet those people. It's a big country, you know, there really are like, you know, billion people there.
A billion people, so that's pretty big.
So what's 50,000 people? It's right. 1 billion, right?
I mean, you know, it's like this is a Tory party, you know, about them.
Okay. But there are there's 1 billion Hindus in the world, or something like 900 million Hindus in the world.
There's certainly things that they burn their bodies.
It's true, they do that.
And the Sikhs actually don't even burn their bodies. What do the Sikhs do?
What do the Sikhs do?
The Sikhs put them on a mountain and they burn
them. Okay.
Okay, so that's religious. They definitely burn their bodies. We were actually at the river.
Okay. So let's pick up with a look at Hinduism itself, and we'll see a little bit about some of its beliefs and so on. So, number one, Hinduism itself has no authority structure where you basically say, you know, I'm the Pope of Hinduism and I'm going to tell you what Hinduism is. And there is a large level of pluralism in the sense that, you know, you can really believe anything you want within the system, basically. And there's a lot of choice as far as, you know, what type of temples you focus towards or move towards. And so now it's all built up as Hinduism. So you might even say, I mean, most of the scholars don't do this, but you might say that there are thousands of religions, we all call them all Hinduism, because there are specific focuses towards different gods in that culture. And a person might say, well, you know, I have a specific affinity towards X god or Y, or my family has this religion with this god and that god, and they would focus towards that god. But the convention has become to group them all in these four ways. Vaishnavism, Shaivism, Shaktism, and Smartism. And the first three are all built upon the worship of a specific god. The first one being Vishnu, the second one being Shiva, and the last one being, the third one being Shakti, and then Smartism is another breakup of people who worship Devi, the god, fourth god, and sort of female goddess of a sort. And so that's the typically the way it breaks up. The denominations differ primarily in the god worship and as the supreme one, as the big god, and the traditions that accompany worship of that god. Now, within those systems, a person can have a primary god, and there can be sub-gods within those systems. And there's a bit of a pantheon within that, and then they can sort of pick out the ones that they focus on. Okay, so that's what's on the ground as far as this, the way that the scholars break it up. But again, these denominations, these breakups are somewhat constructed by the scholars when they look at the scope of all of Hindu religions. They create sort of a breakdown of the various religions based upon the organization of these four deities.
So right here, what is
this is worse than Christianity in the sense that Christianity at least pretends to be monotheistic. Christianity says, you know what, three is one. So the Rabbeinu Tam can get up and say, you know what, that's not really a Avodah Zarah. Because they pretend to be monotheists. They say that, you know, we believe in one God. The one God has three parts. Okay, so you can speak of Shituf and say it that way. Here, they would say that Vishnu is the most powerful God. But there are other gods also. And you can worship gods in different ways in different times. And I think also it's a little bit more pronounced the sense in which they utilize the intermediary as sort of as a physically worshiping the idol itself as part of the worship. Although again, the Rambam, as we saw, would say the same about Christianity as well. So, you know, I can't just defend Rabbeinu Tam, you know, because as you said, in Christianity, you might say, well, if you're the Rambam, you say, yeah, and Hakanami, of course. Christianity is a Bodhisattva, this is a Bodhisattva. Okay. But I want to get now to the theology. And then we're going to jump now off the street, and we're going to go get into the professor's office, and we're going to talk about Hinduism and philosophy. Okay? So what's the common theology that unites us? Well, how can you say this is all one religion? How can you refer to that in that way? So the philosophy that lies behind Hinduism begins with, number one, understanding of a human soul. That there is what's known as the Atman, which is the part of us which lives on and continues on, goes from different life to different life, and moves on, and that's what makes us distinct as souls. And then there's something known as Brahman, which is the Supreme Spirit, which unites us all, that holds us all together, that brings us all as one. And exactly. And that's where those people can get up and say that, in fact, it's not idolatry or whatever it is. Because you have to remember, the Kuzarita says about this also, that behind every form of Avodah Zarah is a basic understanding that at some point, the idol serves to help you understand the truth. And that how do we understand that? How the Jews could worship Chaita Egel? How did you worship a golden calf? How'd that happen?
Well, that happened because they were primitive people, and
they're not that far removed from our worship. But what's the philosophy behind it? How could a person who's at Mount Har Sinai think that? The answer is that they wanted to understand this core, this incorporeal principle, this unbelievable idea of creator of this world and so on. And how do you get your head around that? It's very hard. So you say, well, if I'm able to focus my attention on this physical object and utilize it and bring myself towards a moment of, you know, ecstasy and experiencing the beauty or the symbolic power of this object, I'll be able to then appreciate God in this world in some way. And that's how the Kuzari explains that the Jews, when they first did not have this bad intention. They actually wanted to use the idol in place of Moshe or to be an intermediary towards understanding God.
It's a very primitive thing to have an intermediary. I mean, probably everybody in this room was brought up without that idea, so the idea might seem foreign to us now. I mean, even, you know, my little grandchildren don't expect to see anybody. They know God isn't.
So I'm not sure that primitive is the right word to use about these things, because I think a Hindu would certainly be upset with you, and certainly a Catholic who you know, has a rosaries or whatever else that they have a crucifixes that they use or whatever it is, they would say, you know what, this is actually very meaningful. In fact, you walk into a synagogue, you walk into whatever place is empty. What do you focus on? How do you find inspiration? What's your key to personal connection, personal involvement? Now, I don't want to convince anyone to go up and come and have an Ovid of Avodah Zarah, obviously. That's not our approach. We need to have a little bit of understanding of what's behind it, okay? So that is the key task we're going to find in some of these different philosophies, is to somehow bridge between the soul, the eternal soul of every person, the Atman and the Brahman. How do you unite yourself with this divine concept? Okay? And now we have two different approaches within Buddhism, excuse me, of Hinduism generally. And one is the Advaita Vedanta, and the other is Dvaita Vedanta. One would be known as non-dual thought or non-dual philosophy, and the other one is the dual philosophy. Non-dual Hinduism or non-dual philosophy of understanding this principle is that, in fact, our souls are not different from the Brahman, from the eternal, the supreme spirits. In fact, it's all one. There's no us and God. It's all the same. It's all brought together. And the goal of the religion is to unite those two together. Panentheism, or you know, monism might be another word for it. That you think this world is actually different pieces, you're all wrong. You can only really appreciate and see that everything is one. Everything is all one. Now, the interesting thing to note that this type of philosophy is becoming a language that rabbis are using in Orthodox Judaism. You read some of these Kiruv books, or you read some of these, even, you know, philosophies of Orthodox Judaism, people will talk about the neshama in these ways. They'll talk about what does it mean, neshama chad, and we say shema, we use small terminology to speak about the sense of lack of any barriers between us and God. These Kabbalistics and Kabbalist books will talk about what the principle of chesed is, at least in terminology. And you know, it's sort of interesting to see how this there is a flow, you might say. There's a flow of ideas coming from the East that's affecting our terminology of expressing our own theology. But we can talk about that some other time. Let's move on, though, in terms of our understanding now, going to Dvaita Vedanta, which is, you might so call, dualism. Which is a sense that there's us, our souls, the Atman, and then separate from that is Brahman. The two are separate. And the two are distinct. We are distinct from God. But what is the goal? The goal is to love God. The goal is to come close to God in this sort of separate identities. And by doing so, you achieve the end goal, which we'll see later, is moksha. But those are the two basic goals. And now, oh, that's a good question. Which one is more like Judaism or not? Some might say that the first is like Judaism. Some might say the second is like Judaism. It's not exactly clear, because if you ever notice in Judaism, we don't have animamim that work like this, typically. Now, so we have an animamim that we're supposed to believe Hashem Akeinu, Hashem Echad. So it says in the Torah. What does Echad mean? Does that mean that I'm included in the Echad? Or does that mean I'm not included in the Echad? Not so clear. Okay, so you'll find rabbis who will approach it in a dual way. You'll find rabbis who will approach it in a panentheist way. And the two exist out there. Some of the Hasidic thought is something leans one way, something leans the other way. So I hope that as we go through this discussion, that when people begin to appreciate that in confronting some of this terminology, it causes us to try to become a bit more precise as far as our own thinking within our own tradition about some of these questions.
First one really means that God is a
subtotal
of all of us.
Not just that, but God would be the subtotal, but perhaps also God is above it as well. Be panentheism.
That is true.
What was that?
That is the second one. Would you say that is the second one?
Not from our perspective. No, for us as human beings, if we are God or together with God, we don't exist separately from God. Practically for us, then it's the first. But yeah, I don't want to get too held up here. What I want to do, though, is then come to the next question is, what do the gods then do? Now, if that's the philosophy behind everything, if that's really the core idea behind Hinduism, of this desire to either recognize the ultimate unity, or to form some sense of love and connection between the human being and God, so what do the gods do? What are the gods about? And the answer is that in Hindu thoughts, there are times when the Brahman, this, he tries to take the Dvaita approach, comes and takes a form, an avatar, in which the God comes into existence and is able to communicate with man and give over the Dharma, the view, the Dhamma, the view of life about how we are meant to live. And it's in those forms that the Hindus seek to worship the Brahman, the ultimate identity. So as where we as have Naviyim, by which we understand God, the Hindus have avatars, they have these forms that gods take that they then worship. So that's what Vishnu, Brahma, Krishna, all these various forms are all about that. And then their texts, or their holy texts, so there's no, it's for the same sort of limits that we have in ours, sort of take the form of how the gods have come into this world to convey the ideology to the Hindus. So if you follow along here, Hindu epica and Puranas relate several episodes of the descent of gods to earth in the corporeal form in order to restore Dharma, the correct way of life in society, and guide humans to moksha, liberation from the cycle of rebirth, which is similar to what we saw last week in Buddhism as far as that philosophy. Such an incarnation is called an avatar. The most prominent avatars are of Vishnu and include Rama, the protagonist in Ramayana, and Krishna, a central figure in the epic, the Mahabharata, also part of the Mahabharata is the Bhagavad Gita, which is perhaps the most famous of the Hindu texts, which has entered into our culture. And basically those texts tell stories about great battles, and about Vishnu coming in and having communications with man about how to properly live life. And that's what we're going to see is the Dharma that we're about to read about. Okay?
So we can all become avatars.
Could you become an avatar? That's not really the goal. In other words, the avatar is something that just happens, that the gods come into this world and then go and then teach people things.
But the liberation from the cycle of rebirth.
Okay, so that is that when you as a human being are able to experience moksha, you leave by having fulfilled your karmic work. Then you would then cease to exist, or you would unite with the ultimate spirits. In other words, you would then join with the Brahman and your individual soul, your Atman, would stop to exist and you'd unite with the Brahman.
And then the Brahman decides to send an avatar, then...
That's a separate point. That's nothing to do with you and you. In other words, you just have to listen to it when the avatar comes and tells you how properly to live, then you listen. But you don't become an evocation of God necessarily.
Who rules this whole sector?
Well, that depends on what level of philosophy you want to talk about. If you want to talk about it as far as the big philosophical point, then it's all one. There's no question of rule. It's total existence. If you want to talk about it on a more basic level, then there is, we'll get to this next point right now, which is the idea of karma. And the Buddhism is something similar to this as well, but basically it means action. But it's not just action in a, you know, Newtonian sense. But it's action in a moralistic sense, where every action that you do will have an imprint on you, the doer. If you do something, you are changed by that action, and the world around you is changed by that action. And the moral law of cause and effect, basically. And according to the Upanishads, an individual develops impressions from actions, whether physical or mental. That if you live a life a certain way, you become changed as a result. And you will receive not necessarily punishments, but you will be changed fundamentally by those actions that you've done. And also with that kind of reincarnation, you will receive your karmic comeuppance in some other reincarnation if your karma is bad. If you've done bad things in the course of your life, you will have it come back to you. And then they come to their sense of both free will and destiny. Because you are responsible for your own actions, because you can control your karma based on how you live your life. And now we're going to get to the Dharma, which is the way of life that the avatars come and give to man, and what is expressed in the Upanishad, expressed in the Vedas.
Let's go back to the beginning a little bit. Hinduism centered mostly in India, right?
Correct.
And was there
because Vedic traditions, which go very far back, we're talking 3,000 years ago or so, and then you have the Upanishads, which are 400, 500, 600, 700 before the Common Era, and you have different texts. You have a very large oral tradition which goes back very far. And it doesn't seem to be a specific person, as far as we know, although there were many great scholars who come up at different times and explain and expand upon it, but there isn't a central figure like there was in Buddhism.
It's actually the oldest religion.
They claim to be the oldest religion. I personally think that Judaism is probably a little bit older.
Is it?
Yeah. But, maybe they are older, I don't know. But they say 3,000 before the Common Era, so when did Avraham Avinu live? 1948 before the Common Era? You're in the realm of oral traditions, and then how do you say, where does, the given Hinduism that we find today, is it, where do you define it as being a religion? That's what you consider it to be a straight correlate for what we are now. I mean, you start getting to see the question about us as well. We're rabbinic Jews. So where does Judaism begin? Does it begin with Avraham Avinu? Does it begin with Moshe Rabbeinu? Does it begin with Yehuda HaNasi? Does it begin with Rabban Gamliel? Where does it begin? Where you say, okay, that's where the religion, you say it begins from. So we say it begins from Kabbalah Torah, you might say.
Okay,
but
certainly it didn't start before Avraham Avinu. That's the earliest.
Right, okay. So there could very well be that there are parts of this tradition which go back further.
Okay, Hinduism is older than Buddhism.
Correct, that's certainly true.
500, 750 before?
Right, that was 500 before the Common Era or so.
Yeah. And
again, it's approximation. We don't have exact dates.
People were trying to find ways to explain the similarity
world and how to live life. Absolutely, but I think it's also interesting to note that the similarity between Buddhism and Hinduism as far as some of their key base, their key points. In other words, both Buddhism and Hinduism share this idea that the goal is to separate yourself from this world.
So Tchiyas HaMeisim is out.
Well, they have it automatically, but they want to stop Tchiyas HaMeisim. For us, Tchiyas HaMeisim is the best thing in the world. But that is terrible. They're trying to stop Tchiyas HaMeisim. That's their whole goal. That's an interesting thing. There's a significant difference there.
Okay, but it's coming in the same area of the world.
Correct. Because there's sort of this cultural understanding of what existence is they're both responding to. They're coming out of the same soil. Okay, so let's get finished up because I know we're over time already and we still want to get back to Tarapati to talk about the wigs. So we got to keep it moving here a little bit. Okay, so now we're on to Dharma. So there are two different types of Dharma. I'm sure there are many more, but this is one summary of it. There are four goals of a person, one being sensual pleasure, material prosperity, correct action, the Dharma there, correct action in accordance with one's particular duty and spiritual laws. One has a specific duty, one has a specific role to play that you are fixed in, and has specific spiritual laws for you in that place in society that you fill. And finally, hang on, it's moksha, which is liberation from the cycle of samsara, which is liberation from the cycle of reincarnation. And as we see, the goal here is that you should live one and two with the values of three, or with the limits of three, for the eventual goal of four. Okay, that is the first approach. The second approach recognizes 1, 2, 3, and 4, 1, 2, and 3, but says that 1, 2, and 3 really don't matter. What we're really after is 4. And what we try to accomplish is to forget that 1, 2, and 2, certainly, and achieve 4. Okay? To achieve liberation from the cycle of samsara. Okay? Now, let's now go talk about some of the ways in which you accomplish these goals. Whatever way a Hindu defines the goal of life, there are several methods, yogas, that sages have taught for reaching that goal. Now, I'm giving a couple of them, but there are many more. The path of love and devotion, the path of right action, the path of meditation, the path of wisdom. And what you would do is you would try to bridge or utilize some of these techniques in order to come close. When you find that Hindus meditate, what they're trying to meditate on is trying to achieve the right life, the Dharma, and live their life the proper way. So one of the ways they try to achieve that is through yoga, is through meditation. What they do is through study, through wisdom. One way to try to do that is through bhakti yoga, through love and devotion, which is perhaps some of the worship of the idols that then is that same devotion, that same love they express in that service.
Buddha just seems to be associated with dharma, mostly because it's that correct action, right?
No. Buddhism is a different system. We discussed it last week. Buddhism is different from this. We're talking Hinduism now. Buddhism is not a form of Hinduism. Buddhism is separate. Okay? There are many parallels, but they're different. Okay?
We can get a better idea about Hinduism if we talk in terms of how Hinduism is similar to Judaism and how it's different from Judaism. And let me sum it up that way.
It's totally different than Judaism. It's totally different. We believe in one God. They believe in many gods or perhaps three different sort of...
The mode of life is the same, no?
What was that?
To lead the moral life.
Okay, that's certainly true. Now, they certainly have a law code. They're very much law focused in many ways. A way of life is very essential to them. But we'll see in this next part also that many Hindus believe that you can't become a Hindu. You're either born into an Indian culture or you're not. And then there's also a question of whether the caste system in India is part of Hinduism as well. Because again, as discussed earlier, the bridge between where religion is, or the faith system exists, and where a culture exists is not a clear line like we in the West might have it. So let's look at the last section here. Hindu society has traditionally been characterized into four classes. Varnas, the Brahmins, which are the teachers and the priests. The two is the Kshatriyas, which are the warriors, and the nobles and the kings. Then the Vaishyas, the farmers, merchants, and businessmen. And finally, the Shudras, the servants and the laborers. And those are the specific roles. And each one has specific Vedas, or specific laws, specific almost halachos, la'avdil, which tell them how to live in their role in society. So it's really a system where you are told, based upon your birth, what God expects of you, or what the gods expect of you. And you're meant to fit into that place in society. So the Vedas themselves, the religion itself, focuses not on a universal concept of men. Whereas for us, God speaks to the Jews in a single voice. There is one halacha for all Jews. Now you might be a Kohen, which means you have certain unique halachas that you have that apply to you. Get married a Grusha, get married a divorcee. Basically, there's one message. For the Hindus, there's different messages for different spots in society. A Brahmin has a specific laws that apply to a Brahmin. The Vashyas have a separate set of halakhas that apply to him. And those are different. Those are not the same.
Then they're the untouchables.
But that's even lower, right? That's
the only way the only way to get out of these systems is to
right.
Or to change your name. Because the name indicates...
It's more than just name, it's also face coloration. It's
yeah,
the,
right.
Right, but
because you're right, it's called colors, what it means
right.
In Sanskrit.
People who pass, but they're held back by their name.
Right.
So they go and they change their name because they can't get a job in a certain area because...
Because of the caste system, absolutely.
Right. And even though it's been outlawed, it's still around.
Absolutely, of course. I mean, in other words, this is something which is very deeply ingrained in the culture. It's a something which is very much also connected to the religion as well.
And that's what a lot of
it is. Love and leave.
And that's
where they can get out of this. Okay, we're just going to finish up, just getting back to the website now from this temple in Tirupati. Tantra, the act of shaving your head to propitiate God is a long-standing ritual associated with Tirumala. As per the Vaishnavite tradition, devotees offer their hair to the Lord, which symbolizes effacing of the ego. So what is the website? You know, I'm sure that the Machlokas is over there also. But as the website of this temple speak about the process, it says both. It says it's for the gods, but you serve the God by propitiating the ego. But it really is to propitiate the God. So,
Taking it away.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. tantra used to be done at cottages itself, at the cottages itself in the past, where a barber could be summoned. The new addition is a centralized system which has been put in place at Kalyanakata, a huge building near the temple. Now all the barbers sit there in alongside each other once you enter the complex. The devotees can pay as per their discretion to the barber after tantring. I saw other places where they actually had a fixed pay scale. A bathroom has been provided next to the Kalyanataka facility to facilitate the devotees to take bath. Alternately, a holy dip in the Pushkarini can also take bath. That's the river. After which the devotees are then supposed to visit the temple for darshan, which is their service. And that's what we find here is that you have this divide between the philosophy up there and how a Bodhisattva can come to become a Bodhisattva, and then as far as what actually takes place in reality. And as I mentioned before, the same way you get wigs from all over the world, and the sort of a flattening of the earth, globalization really means that we're coming in contact with what we've had in the past. And halacha now has to respond to that reality such that a rabbi in Israel has to send somebody off to southern India to find out what's going on there, because it has halachic nafkaminas, it has implications to how we live our lives in New York today. And everything's becoming interconnected in a way that through a deeper understanding of what takes place and the thought behind it, and also to understand this divide between philosophy and the practice of these religions becomes so critical. And
so what's the bottom line?
The bottom line is that Hinduism is idolatry, and that the final psak on this issue is that hair coming from those locations, according to the standard practice today, is that we do not, that Chaitanya made a prayer should not be getting materials from such places, and try to ensure that it does not come from those places. The Rebelsky has had hair for it, which I find difficult to understand, because I think that Rabbi Yashim makes a better point here. But again, I'm not your post-take. If you have such shaytalach and you want to ask questions, please ask your local rabbi to find out about what, how to treat such hair sources. But I think that Rabbi Yashim's second understanding is probably much closer to the reality, and that you have to speak not only about the professors and the universities and what they say about the religion, but also what the person on the street is saying and thinking when they approach their gods in these temples. And our appreciation of halacha needs to respond to that reality.
Does this apply to any item which is used or possibly used in a religious ceremony by the Hindus?
Fundamentally, yes. But as we saw with the hair, there could be things that are done outside temples as opposed to inside temples, which may be some distinctions. And you have to make sure or really understand what is going on in those temples. Not every temple is the same. And that's why there's a need for the study.
They sell wedding clothes. The women there get what they call wedding bracelets. Very few. People sell them as antique pieces. Now, it's used in a wedding ceremony. Someone buy it here as a piece of jewelry, or
if you check the provenance and figure it out. Was the prayer rug ever used? What was it made for? And so on and so forth. And what is the idea behind the prayer rug? Is the prayer rug itself part of the devotion, or is it a medium by which you separate yourself from the ground when you do it? And you have to go through the work and really analyze what's going on in each of these places, understand the halakha and nafkaminas of these things. As we saw in this change of thought as far as that issue goes. Now, I really would appreciate feedback from you about what you gained from this class, whether you feel that this attempt to understand some of the large religions of this world, what it does for you as far as your understanding of both Judaism and also understanding of the world more generally. Because I myself am trying to experiment with this class to understand what sort of insights I find from it, what I can give to you, and also I would like feedback from you if you would care to give that. I think that it's just
what happened to give that feedback?
on the feedback forums, and you can certainly call me. If anyone likes to take my card, I'd love to give it to you. If you want to give me a call, just let me have a conversation about these things. And I just want to conclude with just some of the ideas that we started with. To again emphasize the point that Judaism exists in confrontation or in juxtaposition with other faiths, and that we only begin to understand yourself using the terminology of, quote, religion, when you have to meet people who are human beings who you have to relate to and understand, who have different ways of understanding and living their lives. And it's when you have that point of confrontation where you begin to suddenly see yourself slightly differently. It's in those places of contact. And to utilize terminology like religion, as we saw in our first class, is that we don't have a word in biblical Hebrew for religion. You only have it...
What about
dot? Dot, as we saw in our first class, was a word like esh dot lamo, means law. It does not mean religion. Okay? Exactly. Which is from the Megillah. So there is no real word for religion, and that only comes about through the complication. Also that the use of a lot of the interreaction or the interrelation between different faiths are based upon a projection of ourselves in an ideal state, and the other as being somehow in the religion has lived, in with all the frailties and all the failings of the human reality inhabit that religion, and how important it is to understand other faiths with an appreciation for their ideals as well. We don't have sechus to some degree. And I hope also that we got an appreciation for the complexity of how halacha treats things like Christianity and Islam, where we have a great heritage of in halachic literature for the interface between Judaism and the other monotheistic or perhaps not monotheistic faiths. And then as far as Hinduism and Buddhism go, to not want to appreciate the differences between Eastern religions and Western religions that we discussed in the last class, Buddhism, when we began to understand to some degree some of the crucial assumptions that we make as far as what life is. That life is about investing holiness in this world and not just separating ourselves from it, but really caring about political realities, about social realities, about environmental realities. Whereas for the Eastern religions, the goal is to become spiritually separate, to remove ourselves from this world, or remove oneself from this world in the course of that interaction. And in our appreciation of Hinduism, to number one, appreciate how we, as modern Jews, must understand what goes on in Hindu temples. And how the halakha can shift radically as new information comes out about what exactly goes on in these places. And also to see clearly the difference between the religion as defined in the academy or by the priests, and the religion as defined by the person who actually worships. It's been wonderful teaching you. Thank you for your engagement and involvement. Not as of yet. I don't know what's going to happen, but not as of yet. I'm actually, I'll be teaching a class in... for bicultural day school in Stanford next semester. So I'm going to take my Tuesday night slot. I'm not sure if I'll be able to find another slot available or not. I'll have to see. Yes?
One final question. Science seems to be crucial in different religions. What is the attitude of Buddhism and Hinduism vis-a-vis science, differences, similarities, so forth, science?
To be honest, I don't know. I have a feeling that the same way in Judaism that there are those who accommodate and those who reject is likely to exist there as well. Fundamentally, their set of claims are different than the claims about, say, perhaps about creation and things of that sort, but they have specific ideas about the nature of a metaphysical reality, and that degree they would also equally confront a lot of tension with science.
So the answer that for me is I don't know, and that's something to study. Okay.
Thank you.
I leave my gas there.
Please.